tackle the subject of human dignity in the area of abortion and euthanasia, I realize it's the same thing to do in the context in which you have been so bombarded with issues on both sides. I would not like to have you look at what I'm going to say as one more presentation of issues. The work that I represent, Library Fellowship in Switzerland, is basically not an issue-oriented work. It is not that we sort of single out a particular phenomenon that is a discussion in the present and that we would want to contribute our views to. Rather, I think the concern that you will find expressed in the film and the books that go along with it, and also in what I tell you today, is a concern that is born out of a much larger realization. And that larger realization is that, in fact, our private opinions about certain subjects concerning themselves with reality, the reality of our human existence, are relatively insignificant. The greater question we need to ask is the question of what life is and whether there is a truth in the universe as such. I think the danger today is so often that we hide behind our religious views or our views on particular issues that we try to then safeguard without ever coming to grips with the question of how our particular view relates to the reality that surrounds us. I think there's a danger that in fact so often we believe and follow a dream rather than the circumscription of the definite reality that surrounds us and in which we share. The films that were mentioned, Whatever Happened to the Human Race, then should not be seen primarily as dealing with abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, but rather with that recognition of a decline in the perspective that our Western culture has, and the rough spots where that decline of a perspective on the human being in our Western culture indeed intersects with the existence of the human being in history. The area of abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia are not then to be the centers of our observation and of our concern. Our concern ought to be an underlying question, and that is, who is the human being? What is history? How do I deal with the reality that surrounds me, including my own reality? Now then, in the films, you will see that in fact we do hold a strong position. We have come to a conclusion on the issues of abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia. But the reason for that is not that that is a position to hold, as there may be many other positions, but rather it is hopefully the well-reasoned through, if you permit me that grammatical absurdity, is a well-reasoned through conclusion, given all the data that we have about the phenomenon of the human existence. And the conclusion we come to is basically that there is no possibility to define the human being other than as that which he is when he grows up, and that is as a human being from the point of conception until the point of death. But there's no genetic justification for a different view, and there's no biologic or chromosomal justification. That whatever you have in the grown-up, you also have right from the beginning of conception on. Now, I think where our culture today is producing rough spots is at the point at which we no longer know the basic intrinsic difference between man and non-man, or between the human being as a personal being and everything that surrounds us as an impersonal universe. Our culture, with all its emphasis on law and justice, with its emphasis on the rightfulness of medical science and technology, with a justification for social work and even the command for social work in much of that which surrounds us as a Western culture, had a mooring, had a basis, had an intellectual understanding of life that was not geared to the individual faith of its proponents. But it was an intellectual understanding of life that was rooted both in the existence of the definite universe surrounding us, as well as in the awareness of the uniqueness of the human being. And thirdly, in the appreciation of that which the Bible describes as reality, which corresponds to the data that each person confronts in his day-by-day existence. The greater question we need to ask, therefore, is not what do I get out of life or how do I deal with the rough spots of existence, but rather what is the truth of my own existence and how do I understand myself to be, in the midst of history, a human being, rather than a further multiplication of basically an impersonal set of phenomena. Now that worldview has not always been held in our Western society, or what we call Western society. The medieval worldview was much a worldview of escape,
life was minimized, heaven was maximized. Life was seen as a spiritual testing ground for later spiritual fruit. The suffering of mankind was tolerated as an exercise of obedience, rather than as something that needed to be worked on. Spirituality was totally separate from human existence, and the life that was separate from the agony of the human existence was seen to have greater value than actually tilling the ground or working as a mason with stone or building human relationships or dealing with human suffering. That which followed the Renaissance culture was the medieval worldview. What followed the medieval worldview was the Renaissance culture, in which an attempt was made to mathematize the situation surrounding us by reducing all phenomena to that which was natural. That which is natural, however, can only be quantified but not qualified, because nature as such merely is, but expresses no moral obligation and no value differentiation. The attempt was made by the Renaissance thinkers of the early Florentine Republic, for instance, to somehow figure out the mathematics of the universe around us, or the mathematics of the sphere, and if man then could submit himself to the mathematical formulations, he would indeed be in harmony with what was seen as nature and nature's God. It was then the result of the Reformation thinking as a return to the Bible, not as a religious document, but rather as an informative statement of the kind of reality that surrounds us and in which we share, that opened up the door for that which we now call our Western culture. And that is the high view of the human being as distinct from the non-human. It produced a situation in which justice could be differentiated from injustice, and thus law had a rightful place, in which sickness could be differentiated from health, and medicine had a foundation that was not only used in order to decipher the laws of an impersonal universe, but also to use these findings for the purpose of therapy, that is, to improve on the given situation. What is so intrinsically central to the whole Western culture was that history and nature were always seen on the seat of the accused. There was never a statement of resignation to whatever comes to pass. I would, however, say that what surrounds us today is a change from that which we still know in memory of a Western culture. And that change is there in two areas, basically. The one is in the Cartesian thinking, as it was adopted by various people and redefined, but basically a Cartesian thinking that assumes that the only thing you can say with definiteness is that which is in fact reducible to mathematical symbols. And by mathematics, I don't mean sums and additions only, but any kind of reduction to that which later on became the coordinates of positivism. The things that can be repeated, that can be quantified, that in like situations will always produce the same results. Descartes spoke of truth being all that which is clear, evident, and distinct. And Spinoza went a step further when he says that the geometric method must be applied to all human passions as well. And we find in Leibniz's writings the inclusion of God also, as well as man, into the binary system of 1 and 0 that we today have in modern computer language. It is the reduction of existence to the mathematically repeatable formula that could be discovered in the naturalism, the positivism, and today in materialism. The other change, however, is more an intellectual change, as written in the philosophic writings of a person like Kant, and then adopted again and again by the thinkers of today in both the philosophical chairs as well as the thinkers in theology. The change there is a change from an open universe to a closed universe. Those who are familiar with the writings of Lavery would probably understand what I mean. But excuse me if I go and try to explain it again. The open system is basically the recognition that the human being has open spaces of freedom with choice to choose between that which is according with the value system that I've adopted and that which is in disagreement with that value system. It basically says that man is self-originating in some of the things that he's able to choose. Words such as love and choice and creativity have meaning in that kind of a recognition of the phenomenon of the human being. The opposite, the closed system, assumes that indeed man is merely the effect of previous causes, and all our choices are really not choices because there's no freedom there, but rather what surrounds us is indeed a set of predictions, a set of determinants which produce by necessity certain conclusions. Now, much of modern thinking, both in the existentialist camp of France that is associated with French thinkers, as well as the theological camp that is associated with German theological liberalism in the 19th and 20th century, follows that idea of a closing of the system. That is, that the only level upon which we can know something is on the level of mathematics, and that which gave man the high view of himself, namely that we live in an open universe in which there is a person to begin with, the infinite personal God of the Bible, in which man was seen as an image bearer of God, both male and female, is excluded from being considered anymore, precisely because the anthropological wall that is built by Kant's view has been drawn across the horizon. No wonder then that modern man lives in a situation in which we basically say that metaphysically we are surrounded by silence, and our orientation for the things of life must be found by the subjects that surround us, or the objects that surround us. And these, of course, can only be discovered by means of mathematical investigation. What it leads to, and then I would suggest in the areas that are under discussion today, and as I say, these are not only issues, but they must be seen in the context of the whole, in the area of abortion and euthanasia and these questions, our suggestion is that indeed in these areas we find there are spots where the modern philosophical outlook on reality grinds down to the very painful realization that the human being is no longer treasured as a human being. That our evaluation as to the legality of euthanasia on one end of life, or abortion on the other end of life, or infanticide, that is the doing away with those who have severe physical handicaps in the middle of life, is justified on the basis of no longer morality, no longer personal choices in the area of personal morality, but rather in the area of basically mathematic considerations. That is, much speech is held in the level of the quality of life, but actually what is spoken of, if you come right down to it, is a discussion of the quantity of life. That is, the ease of living, the ease of having a planned existence, of mapping out the size of one's family, of deserving vacations at a given time when it has been planned, of a child basically becoming inconvenient, and thus, for one reason or another, either by medical indication, as it's called, or by psychological or social indication, abortion is being advocated increasingly more so. And the same is true at the other end of life, where indeed one speaks of a life that is not worthy to be lived. And this can be spoken of in two areas, either the passive euthanasia, that is the withholding of treatment, or active euthanasia, that is the deliberate termination of treatment for the sake of putting someone to death. Now there again, the justification for it is so often a justification that is born out of mathematics, in this case economics, or social integration, or productivity, or having lived off retirement funds long enough, that is used in order to somehow justify that doing away of the human being as a human being. In other words, instead of the horizon being the realization that man is unique and of value, we now value other things and sacrifice to the maintenance of that value the human being if he becomes inconvenient or socially embarrassing, as one passage in the film says. The only problem with it is, of course, that we cut into our own flesh. The only problem is that if those of us who have survived an abortion indeed may not in the future survive a euthanasia practice. And it is us that we're speaking about, and not some abstraction. We're talking about human beings, and not merely the economics of a given situation. I think Christians have often had a great problem to relate themselves to these very pressing situations that surround us. They're pressing, for in the United States, ever since abortion became legal in 1973, 1 million babies have been aborted. That is 6 million, or 6.5 million, since the abortion ruling. And also we look at the other end of life and try to somehow justify passive or active and euthanasia by some reference to a spirituality which I would suggest is not biblical spirituality. There is no room in Christianity to embrace death as something desired. The passages that Paul uses, I think, are most often misunderstood and taken out of the context in which they're used. The passages that apply are not 2 Corinthians 5, and I think Colossians, but rather the passages, or Philippians rather, the passages that apply to the question is rather 1 Corinthians 15 and others, in which death is seen as the most horrible and gross enemy to the human existence, and as that which cuts across all of life with total democratic evenness, and is the most stark realization that we live in an unacceptable nature, that we live indeed in a situation that is not according to God's will or pleasure. I think Christians have withdrawn out of the discussion so often because they look for Bible verses and chapters in order to come to conclusions instead of concerning themselves with the greater issue of what is truth, what has God said in the whole composite of His Word, rather than in the specificity of a chapter and a verse. They're concerned only for the directness of revelation instead of seeing that the revelation is not a set of predicaments or predications or statements, but rather revelation is indeed God's circumscription of the reality that we live in and what we are to do as creatures in His image in the midst of that reality. I think part of the problem is precisely that view that we hide behind theological justifications as you read articles that a fetus is not a human being until implantation or until it has the first breath. There's no medical or psychological or biblical reason to water down the realization that whatever is there as an adult is already there in completion, genetically and chromosomally, in the fertilized ovum. The other problem I think that we have to come to grips with as Christians, if we call ourselves Christians, is that in the past there have been so often various opinions about life and death itself, that indeed, as I said, death was seen as the great door to heaven instead of as the great enemy which the Bible speaks of. I think furthermore we've all been sucked into the temptations of our age in which we're promised easy solutions for complicated issues and complicated life situations. And we embrace these temptations and put a nice Christian term or surrounding to it and then justify the same thing that a secular world does in the name of economics. I think furthermore the reaction to a person who is pregnant and not married has always been to write it off as a person who is in sin instead of realizing that he is a human being, an image bearer of God as I am, one of my own kind, who is in a situation of the particular need that I must surround with love and care and financial support and human relationships, instead of writing it off as a person who is in sin and thus must bear the consequence of that transgression by herself. And finally, I would say it is a situation in which we have surrounded ourselves by the mentality that is so common to our culture, and that is the mentality basically of avoidance, and that is not being confronted by the agony of the human condition as the French so accurately describe it. And we say that these things are isolated areas. Again and again in the last 3 weeks when I've spoken to different groups, I've come across Christians who undoubtedly mean well, but their usual response is that as Christians they would never perform an abortion, but they have no right to make a statement about other people's lives and their obligations to their conceived children. I would say if we have any understanding of truth rather than merely caring for our own skin, if we have any concern for the things of God rather than merely how to get by, then that is the wrong attitude to have. We should not be Christians if we're not finally convinced that what God has spoken of in the Bible is indeed verifiably true and describes the universe that He has created before the fall, describes the universe and the effects of the fall as it is now, and in such a way that it is applicable to all human beings, as image bearers of God. To indeed withdraw behind the security of a group or a language system or a community is indeed to avoid the tough exposure that we need to a reality that screams for assistance and to which indeed the God of Scripture offers a definite and final solution. But we withdraw behind our words, we go the easy way so easily, we feel secure when we have a few people who are with us, instead of taking to task life itself, nature, the universe, history, and questioning it to the core to find out whether there is indeed a truth and what that truth is and what wonderful answers indeed truth would give in a situation in which we're full of questions. I think so often we hide from the work that needs to be done in order to expose ourselves to these questions. But there's no way out when we come right down to the rough, to the points of friction, to the rough spots that I spoke of before, when we realize that's us they're talking about when abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia are being discussed and increasingly made acceptable in our culture. I wanted to close there so we could have some time to discuss that, and I would urge you to feel free to ask for clarifications or take me to task. Yes, sir.
One is the rationalistic, mechanistic idea of just being mathematics that leads to the justification of certain actions upon pragmatic grounds, and the other, which is Christian way, which is we make our decision upon revelation, and as Christians we must make our decision upon revelation from God and not on the mechanistic attitude of the sexual world.
No. No, I think no. What I'm suggesting is that in fact truth is one. The word truth should only be used if in fact we're willing to incorporate all aspects of reality into it. There's no such thing as private truth. Truth for me. I mean that's what our culture tells us, but there is no such thing. Whatever deserves the name truth is that which is in the exposure to real existence across human history and across geography and so forth still stands as undeniably there. What I'm not saying is that we have one choice or another. We have only one choice. The choice is not between Christianity and the Cartesian thinking. The choice is between living a truth or living a lie. That's right, and we have to take them and we have to see whether in fact any one of them corresponds accurately to the total existence of the human being and the questions that that raises, or whether in fact they don't. In other words, our concern shouldn't be to follow revelation, our concern ought to be to follow the truth. Now the truth of that which surrounds us is in fact answered. The questions arising out of that truth are answered in the Bible, I feel, yes. But I beg your pardon? By the fact that the non-Christian cannot live in a different world. He can't live in a Cartesian world. He can't live in a world in which there is no basis for differentiation. He can't live in a world in which life and death are only statistical figures, in which love and hate are only the outcome of a set of cause and effect chains. We all live in a world in which no matter how Cartesian we are in our thinking, we still act as if we're a person. We desire to be taken seriously in our views.
The word of the non-Christian says that one particular view of the universe, there are others as you tell.
Well, you tell by exposing the view to the universe, by seeing whether a view in fact accurately describes the phenomena under observation and whether it gives an answer to the questions that the phenomenon raises. No, I don't think so. I think it is revelation objectively, but that revelation isn't a way out of the, is not an explanation of the situation. I think it's revelation because that's the kind of world we live in, where there is a God, where there is a person. But that isn't the presupposition I start with. That's the conclusion I have to come to when I expose myself to the reality of human existence. What's my view on therapeutic abortion? Well, I see the human being as a human being from the point of conception on. And thus the killing of the unborn child is the killing of a human being. Now then, having said that, I'm very glad to find out that the need for a therapeutic abortion has been constantly decreased due to the advances in medical science, so that it practically doesn't occur anymore. In all the 50,000 abortions that were performed in Australia in the last year, the medical indication was justified in less than 1%. But you do have a situation in which, in fact, you have a real conflict, a conflict between the life of the mother and the life of the unborn child, where you do have to make a choice. But it's not a choice that's justified and coldly dealt with on the level of saying, well, that's the way we have to go. But rather, it's the realization that we live in a universe which is broken, which has fallen, where you do have conflict situations. I don't know what tests you can have, quite frankly. I mean, you can have tests that maybe there's a doctor who can tell us. you have even had tests for Mongolism, but the tests for Mongolism do not reveal the degree of Mongolism. There's no way to find out whether in fact you have a severely Mongolized child or not. But you see, it seems to me that you have to, rather than dealing only with the individual cases, what you have to come down to is what is the basis upon which you're going to look at life in general. And then that's going to color your decision in an individual situation. But I would say a human being is a human being. It isn't just a perfect human being that becomes a human being by degree of its perfection. He's a human being as a human being. The distinction isn't whether you're 90% perfect or 100% perfect, do you see? But rather whether you have human beings there or whether you don't have human beings. Now, a modern culture doesn't have any more basis to differentiate between human beings and everything else. So it makes a different differentiation, a differentiation on the basis of economics, social integration, psychological health, of whether in fact you can maintain the lifestyle that you're used to by having one more eater in the family, etc. And that is a view that I say is unacceptable in life, not from a Christian perspective as a Christian, but from the perspective of reality itself. Yes. I think you have to move in the right direction. But the thing is, I probably, in a similar situation, I probably would have talked to her about life. Rather than, in other words, the opposite of what her parents were doing, or would have done. And that is, of course, to get pregnant changes all of life. And there's no way that you can, through an abortion, pretend that it's not changing all of life. So now that life has changed, let us see with a new situation. How exciting, indeed, to be able to give birth to a human being. How fantastic the reality of the world is because of the existence of a human being. Now let us see what we can practically do to make that possible. But not as just as a Christian, but as a human being. I mean, in a sense, you see, to put a person into a situation where they have an abortion is in fact to condemn the murder of a child. Now, if I see it that way, then I have a tremendous obligation to do something. And if I can't do it, I ought to bring the bell. I don't know where, somewhere where a community could listen. Something is going on here. You better get together. But of course it's very difficult in today's culture because you seem to be socially irresponsible if you do keep the baby. You know, you got caught and so forth, and you're dumb to get caught, so why don't you free yourself once you've been caught? I mean, that's the tenure of the society's mentality in the world around us. That's right, and that's, I think, where we have an obligation as Christians to surround a person like that with very practical help. And if we can't do it, then maybe we ought to go to offices, agencies, churches, shake people up a bit. That we're not going to tolerate the murder of innocents. we're not going to have a situation in which the people who have to bear the consequence of pregnancy is the person who can't open his mouth to say something about it. I can say something about it, so I should. And all love and care, yes, but I should. I can't. I mean, it's in a sense that it's like standing aside when I realize that the fellow Germans of mine, or that before I was born, but fellow Germans were carted off to the death camp. But somebody should have rung the bell, and some people did. I'm glad. There's a lot more people should have rung the bell.
That's
right. World War One, they didn't. That's right. Jackie, it didn't start with Jews. It started with people who didn't quite fit into the picture.
The grace comes from Psalm
The only thing is, you have to be very careful in today's discussion when you come and open your Bible and find that statement which is true. There will be a host of people who will no longer listen to your argument, because they will look at it as your position that you religiously hold to, because obviously otherwise you wouldn't be a Christian. But it's not necessarily tied down to the way things are, as I use the word truth. And what we have to point out is that, in fact, that whether you start by looking at the Bible and seeing what it says about what God says about the reality, or whether you start from reality and ask questions and look for possible answers, you come out in the same situation, and that is what the truth of life is. The human being is a human being. In other words, if the Bible says that there is no distinction between the human being and the stick and the stone, I would say the Bible isn't true. Because phenomenologically, I see that the human being is different from everything that's not human. And the reason I can be a Christian is because, observing reality, I find that the Bible gives me a sufficient explanation. It agrees, and then gives me further explanation beyond that which I can see.
But obviously the Bible doesn't say that.
I beg your pardon?
But obviously the Bible doesn't say that.
It doesn't say what?
There's no
difference in the thing. That's right, but what I'm saying is that my authority is not the Bible. My authority is truth. And the truth is that there is a God out there who's given me the Bible. But truth matters more than the teachings of the Bible.
And have you some proposed statement of truth
in God? Well, I think by what, I don't know how much that bears on the film. Carry on with the film first. I don't think you can objectively prove anything. That's not so, because I also recognize my own finite insight, and thus I function on the basis. I live on the basis of overwhelming evidence, all in one direction, with no evidence against it. But that's not absolute truth. I, as a finite being, can never have absolute truth. I can only live by what God has told me. I don't have absolute truth about the chair in which my feet are. You see, why I said that is because I think in today's discussion, sometimes, precisely because the modern world sees that the only truth, the word is used, scientifically, is that which can be verified in the reaction by. And then on top of that, the modern culture out that surrounds us uses a different meaning for the word truth, and that is truth for you. Now, as a human being first, and then as a Christian, I would say there's no possible way I hope there would be no possible way that I would ever be satisfied to live in that kind of existence. But rather, when I say truth, it must be true for everything, and there is one truth, rather than two truths. Now then, the danger is, you see, when you talk to a person who is in a situation like that, or any other person, that when you say the Bible says, they automatically will respond, oh, that's your religious trip. That's true for you. I'm so glad you have a faith. I'm utterly pleased that it has changed your life. It's wonderful how it gives meaning to your study. But of course, it's not true. It doesn't have any eyes. It's only true insofar as it has produced certain results. But it isn't true in the sense that I am under the same, in the same reality, in the same, under the same judgment of history.
But Christians shouldn't have concern on this matter because of the physical basis.
I think it's not
a basis.
Well, now, why are you a Christian, though?
Because I believe in Christ.
Why do you believe in Christ?
Because I experience Christ.
How do you know you experience Christ?
It's surely
a comfort.
It's surely a.
You see, I think that's a weak basis. I don't deny the reality that I can't. Because I can't be more serious. But I would say that's a highly weak, a very, very weak basis that the Bible never uses as justification for its teaching.
What about love? You prove that you love
That's true, but I can judge whether it's love or not by the way it's being lived out in its implication. And likewise, the God of the Old and New Testament and the person of Christ can be examined by the way it, that which he claims about himself and gives by revelation corresponds to the reality of his creation. In other words, God never said, I am God, and I say this, now you do. No, it's rather, why don't you look at reality and why do you then follow a lie rather than the truth? Because especially in a culture that is so experience oriented, we must be utterly careful that we don't present one experience against another experience. No, we can have the God of the living against a lie.
Tell us more about what you were saying before, that this is the passage in the Bible that there's nothing to do with. I may not be right in the sense of the word, but not to say that you should use that as something that's a horrible insult in your life. It seems to me that you have more basis for saying that's wrong to think. While I'm not accepting the idea of calling that, I still find hard to reconcile the idea of looking at that as a horrible thing.
Well, I agree with the second half of your first sentence, but not with the first. precisely, I think Christ's word, yes, it removes the sting, and thus death does not have to be feared. That's the part I didn't agree with. I didn't say that death has to be feared. Death does not have to be feared, no. But death has to be false. It is an obscenity. It is that which is unacceptable to God. It is that which is the most equally distributed evidence of the fact that we live in a broken universe which is not acceptable. So why should we accept it? Christ was furious at the death of Lazarus. He did not just provide us with a short skirt. He did not just provide, he didn't just say, Jesus, death is well, it's good. Holy power. Christ was furious at the death of Lazarus. Paul, when he says the sting of death is removed, in the same context, the same chapter, in the same part of the chapter, he says that only when Christ returns will the last enemy, which is death, be removed. Well, now, I think the tendency is in our culture, both secular and Christian, is to forget that death is an enemy. And we see it as a portal to heaven. It's not, it's an enemy. That there is a heaven after our dies is the benefit of Christ's work and the fulfillment of his promise, and that's wonderful. But I'd rather go to heaven without having to die. And that's what Paul says. And in Thessalonians, he points out that there will be a generation that will return a Christ that will not die. So we must weep, but not as those who have no hope. Well, why don't Christians weep? Why don't Christians mourn? Why do they come up and say, it was the right, it was the Lord's will, or the Lord's called me home to himself, because of that thing? You see, but now, you see, it goes further than that, and that is, I think it's the only way we can understand our whole Western culture with its Christian basis, is if we understand that view of life and death. Because medicine is only justified if, in fact, I understand death to be objectionable. Then I go to a physician so that he can help me combat it. Then I can give my cornea to a blind person as I die, so that at least something of me will continue to be used. Because death is an alternative.